Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Thanks again for your company on another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Now, this year, we have pushed the show out to an hour, as we said. Last year's season was half an hour. We've pushed it out to an hour. I think I might make an exception this time, and we might push it out to about 4 hours, because I think we're going to need it. Because my guest in the studio today is one of the most familiar faces and voices in Australian sports broadcasting. He has the Order of Australia medal, and he is a broadcasting legend, and I'm happy to say he's been a good mate of mine for a long time. Drew Morfitt, welcome along.
PD, thanks very much for having me.
Lovely to see you as a winning owner over the Flemington Carnival. Of course, we record this not long after the Flemington Carnival, but it was a carnival you won't forget in a hurry.
Well, it was unbelievable because I had a little share in a winner on Caulfield Cup Day and a little share in a winner on Melbourne Cup Day. Mm. What a double. That'll never happen to me again in my life. I've been fiddling around having small shares in horses for about 18 or 19 years. We've never won a race at Flemington, so we picked Cup Day to break the drought. It was just enormous. Look, the two races, one horse was Andreoli, trained by Robert Smurden, who won on Caulfield Cup Day. And then we had Invincible Heart, trained by Mick Price, who won on Melbourne Cup Day. Now, I reckon both races were probably the worst races on the day, and our horses weren't the best horses in the field
either time.
But we got a champion ride from Craig Williams, Caulfield Cup Day, and a brilliant ride, Craig Newitt, on Melbourne Cup Day. So thanks for the two Craigs that were up there.
I did happen to mention to Mick Price in the post-race interview that the celebrations would probably be reasonably boisterous, knowing you. Did you have one or two that night?
You know what? I watched the Melbourne Cup, the history-making Melbourne Cup, with Payne and Weir, and it was unbelievable. I was up near the train, so I watched it on the big screen. And I was on the train at about 10 past three. Race was run at 3 o'clock. I was on the train at 10 past three, drove in at home at Pakenham South at about 10 past five. I reckon we had takeaway and clean skin reds.
Wow. I would have thought it might have been a bit more rowdy than that.
No, it was pretty quiet. You know, when you got to get home and do things with horses and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, just couldn't wait to get the kit off and get the shorts on and, you know, sloth around at home.
I didn't know where you were going when you said get the kit off.
Don't read anything into it.
Righto. I'll get back to your life with horses and all that sort of thing later in the program. Mm-hmm. But what about that moment, even though you saw it on the big screen, that moment that was 154 years in the making, that was one of the most memorable Melbourne Cups that we will ever see.
We will ever see. It's right up there with Ollie winning on Media Puzzle. But, yeah, to break through and to be the first female jockey to win the Melbourne Cup, Frankie Dettori was second. Gerald Mosse was last. Wasn't his fault. The horse broke down, basically. But you had these world-famous riders, and he was the only female rider in the event, just showing them a clean pair of heels. It was just fantastic. You know, I've known her reasonably well over a lot of years. You know, she plays in the cricket match for the Jockeys Trust, which I've done, you know, the commentary on, stuff like that. So I know Michelle pretty well. She's just a beautiful lady, terrific rider. There was a photo on the front page of the Herald Sun. She had a pink or red dress on with a white hat. And she looked every bit as good as all those models that they have taken their photos with horses leading up to the Spring Carnival.
I said exactly the same thing when I saw her on Oaks Day. She would have been not out of place on the catwalk at Fashions on the Field. Yeah,
gorgeous.
And a lovely young lady as well.
Yeah.
What a moment. One that we'll never forget. Tell me, when did Andrew Morfitt become Drew Morfitt?
I haven't been Andrew since I was sitting on the wet grass and my mother would say, "Andrew! Get off the wet grass. You'll get piles." but I've had to become Andrew again because it's Andrew on the passport, and therefore on an air ticket, it's got to be Andrew. And I've said to so many people at the various airlines, "Can't I be Drew? Everyone knows me as Drew." "No, well, it's come through as Andrew." So I said, "What do you do with people like Bill, William? you know, it might be W. Allen, but everyone knows him as Bill Allen sort of thing. Anyway, so there's a bit of Andrew. That's the official name, but I've been Drew because my mother said, I don't want my son to be called Andy. I hate it. So if you have to shorten it, Drew is what it's going to be. So I've been Drew for donkey's years.
And when you were sitting on that wet grass as a young kid, that would have been probably in Sydney where you were born.
Yeah.
And yet here you are in Melbourne, which has been such a part of your life, and a game that you probably knew nothing about in your early years has become a very big part of your life in AFL football.
Well, correct weight on that. I knew absolutely nothing about the game. Started at the ABC in Sydney when I was 18, and the first time I came out of my cadetship, sort of about a two-year period, the first job that became available was Perth. So I lobbed over in Perth, and I didn't know how many blokes made up a team in Aussie rules. Knew nothing about the game whatsoever. So I learnt it from scratch over there, made all the mistakes over there, so hopefully there are people in the Pilbara and all that who can remember me saying, you know, kicks into touch and over the halfway line when I'm trying to broadcast Aussie rules. You know, made all those mistakes. I actually did the carnival in Perth in 1972, and a bloke recently sent me a copy of it, which was transferred from reel-to-reel tape onto a CD, and actually, it was half all right. I thought it'd be a disgrace because it was very early on in my... 72 is a hell of a long time ago. Mm. But it was half all right. I was broadcasting with George Grilicic.
Yes.
And he broadcast the socks off me, of course. George would do about 20 minutes a quarter and I'd do about five.
Yes.
That was the sort of deal. But, you know, Peter McKenna was playing and... Cable for Western Australia and Matthews for Victoria. Yeah,
take us back before you went to Perth. What ignited the spark in you about sports broadcasting? Was it a particular broadcaster who did it? Was it a series of events? Where did that come from?
Well, my father was a member of the Sydney Cricket Ground, and he was dragging me out there to watch cricket and rugby league games from the time I can pretty much remember. I can remember, you know, hitting a tennis ball against the wall out the back of the MA Noble stand when I was maybe seven or eight, that sort of thing. There was a bloke, a ball fella named Ray. He was a race caller, a trots caller or something. Until for the life of me, now I can't think of his surname. And I can remember getting his autograph, and he looked embarrassed that I'd asked him for his autograph because he thought, you know, there are cricketers and footballers around. Why would you be asking for my autograph? And actually, that's happened to me a few times. Well, I'm thinking, turn it up. But I can understand how kids would see a bloke who's a broadcaster and in a favoured spot who'd be a bit of a hero. And he was. You know, Rex Mossop. I grew up with Rex Mossop and Sydney's Juan Casey. But the ABC blokes, you know, Alan McGilvray broadcasting cricket, Norman May, who could broadcast anything. And my first day at work, I walked into the office. There was McGilvray, May, Jeff Marnie. I'm thinking, oh, this is unbelievable. I was like a kid in a lolly shop. It was fantastic.
And you couldn't have gone to a better place than the ABC because when you go there, you call everything. You don't go as a specialist and you get thrown in at the deep end sometimes, which is a great thing for broadcasters.
I can remember my boss one day sent me out to the Queen's Prize rifle shoot. And I said, I know nothing about rifle shooting. I was in the cadets at school and we had 303s and I couldn't hit a target, you know, from 30 yards, all that sort of stuff. And he said, you know what, if you're doing a sport that's a minor sport like that, you just get out there and find the reigning Australian champion and ask him about it, and he'll be flattered that somebody's asked him about his sport. It's a bit different if you're, you know, talking cricket and football and stuff like that, but a so-called minor sport. Get hold of the Australian champion, ask him a few questions, and within half an hour you'll know all about the sport. And it's exactly what happened. So over the years, because I was at the ABC, I've done, motorbikes at Calder. I reckon I interviewed Peter Brock on the grid at Sandown in the second weekend of September, so I missed a footy final, you know, 8-9 years in a row. They weren't sports that I was absolutely, you know, dying to see, but once you get there... I've done lawn bowls. I've never counted them up. But there have been plenty of sports that I've never played, don't know anything about, but somehow you ask the right people, ask the right questions, you learn something about it.
And it also, as a broadcaster, helps you to think on your feet because there is no way that you can have dead air going to air. Something, especially on radio, you have to be saying something and describing something. And even if you don't know anything about it, and you're one of the great ones of being able to do this, that you were able to find the words even when you might have been struggling to find them.
We did the water skiing, didn't we?
We did. We did.
We don't know anything about that.
That was good fun, though. I love those days in the water skiing.
Yeah, I can remember the year you said to me, Dandy, Andy won the Australian Cup, and we were on the men's slalom or something at the time. I don't know about filling dead air. Actually, I'm one of these blokes. I don't mind the odd bit of dead air because I was always taught that there are aspects to a broadcast, especially a radio broadcast. There is speech, effects, and silence. Mm-hmm. And I was told never underestimate silence, because if Dennis Lilly's at the top of his mark and he's bowling to Colin Cowdery with his arm in plaster, and Lilly is bowling at the whacker at 100 miles an hour with a roaring, you know, Fremantle doctor behind him, and you paint that picture and pause for a second and a half and let the listener think, Jesus Christ, what's going through Cowdery's mind? Mm. A bit of pausing is great. So I don't mind a little bit of so-called dead air.
Yeah, but that's the difference between you and other broadcasters, in particular on radio, because it's not dead air, because there's that a sense of anticipation. The crowd is roaring. There's still the atmosphere, and that is, in my opinion, what makes you such a great broadcaster, that you feel the moment. You're very much a part of the moment. You're not only watching and describing what's going on, but you're involved in the whole theatre of the thing.
Gee, you do me a big favour. Well, I hope I've been able to do that, but a lot of it is just a bit of research, a lot of bullshit thrown in as well. But feeling the moment. For instance, when Richie Beno died earlier this year, everybody said, what a great man, that less is more, that his words were so clipped and minimal that, I mean, when Warnie bowled the ball of the century, Richie took about 3 seconds to say anything. You know what he said? He's done it. And I thought, I don't think that's the greatest commentary I've ever heard in my life. Mm. He's done it. But when he died, everybody said what a great man Richie was for less is more. And I'm happy to be in the school of a bit less is more, yeah.
Did you have much to do with Richie in your time broadcasting cricket?
He wasn't all that forthcoming certainly advice or even sort of conversation, really. At the back of the media centre at the MCG, there's a little card table set aside, and it's Richie's table. And Richie would sit there with his computer and everything, but he was never going through cricket stats or anything like that. He was putting on his quaddy. So you walk past and ask Richie what his best bet for the day was, and you could get him going on something like that. Mm. That's nearly the extent to which my conversation went with Richie, because I was just an underling and Richie was God. Honestly, and that's how I treated him. He might have treated himself a bit like that too, just quite.
The only times I ever got to see Richie, because I was not in your inner sanctum at the cricket in the broadcasting area, but I'd see him at the golf every now and then because he was a regular in the media centre. Mm. He and Daphne at various times would pop into the media centre at the big golf tournaments when golf was really big in this country.
Yeah, I can remember when I was a kid in Perth, I'm on my own in the office one day, and I've got to prepare Sporting Highlights, which is a 15-minute radio program. Can be a bit of cricket, bit of footy, bit of racing, race results from, you know, Northam or something like that. And I thought, I wonder if the draw for the Sheffield Shield is out yet. And, I mean, these days you could get it on the internet. Boom, no trouble at all. But in those days you had to hunt it up. And Richie and Daphne were the media mouthpiece for Cricket Australia, or the Australian Cricket Board, as it was at the time. So I thought, I'll ring Richie. No, I won't ring him. I sent him a telex, which is...
Yes.
You can't believe that I'm doing this. It's 40 years ago or something. And I sent him a telex, and it was something like, couldst please advise, if available, Sheffield Shield draw for coming summer. And I got one back saying, very interested in your offer, happy to talk more. He thought I was offering him a job, because I worded it, couldst please advise if available.
Yeah.
And he thought, buddy, the ABC station in Perth, little Drew Morfitt, might have been offering him a gig. And he was probably, you know, getting a gig here, there and everywhere, and bit in the back pocket and then a bit in the right pocket and whatever else. And when the boss came in the next day and I showed it to him, he roared laughing. He held his sides laughing and got in touch with Richie. And, you know, it was just a misunderstanding. But that was little me at about the age of 21 dealing with Richie, former great Australian test captain.
We'll talk more about you as a young man and the transition from Perth over to Victoria, where you've made your home, on the other side of the break. We're speaking to one of Australia's broadcasting legends, Drew Morfitt, and it is a very special edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Wonderful to have your company on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives, and a true legend of the broadcasting caper in Australia, Australian sport. And he's a worldwide legend because Australian sports broadcasters are as good as any in the world. Would you go along with that, Drew Morfitt?
I would, absolutely. Actually, over the years, I've quite liked New Zealand broadcasters. People might hate me saying that, but I think they cover various sports pretty well. But no, Aussies are right up there.
Was there one as a young man who, when you listened to him, you thought, I'd like to be like him? And did you model yourself on a particular person?
It was Jim Fitzmaurice, who was my boss in Perth, and he finished up becoming a big wheel at Channel 9 and then a director of the company with a bloke named Mike Watts, who distributes the rights for major sporting events worldwide. All Test cricket, Olympics, whatever else. Actually, Mike Watts, he owned outright a horse that was favourite in the Melbourne Cup and ran second. And if I had a better memory, I'll be able to tell you what his name was. An English horse. It might have run second to Ollie the day he won on Media Puzzle.
Mr. Prudent ran third in that race. You've got me. What ran second? We'll find out.
Yeah, anyway, so Jim was a director of that company in his years after the ABC and after Channel 9. But he was my boss in Perth. I got to Perth when I was 20, and Jim was trim, taut and terrific, looked fantastic on television, delivered it beautifully, commentated Olympics, footy, test cricket and all that sort of stuff. And as a matter of fact, I've been mistaken for him a few times. His voice might have been a little bit similar, but some of his calls were legendary. He was at the Olympics in 72 in Munich, and he had a view from his room of the blokes with the hoods and the guns and all that sort of stuff. And he was live into Perth for Today Tonight at 7:30 at night or something. He's pretty much woken up, and they rang him and said, "Tell me what's going on." He said, "What do you mean, what's going on?" It was 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 a.m. for him. And he finished up opening the curtain and pretty much describing it live on television into prime time in Perth. He was a beauty, Jim. And so I still keep in touch with him. He'd be a fair age now. I know that because I'm a fair age. So.
No, you're going all right. You haven't changed much over the years. By the way, Andy, who's in the studio with us, Mr. Pruden ran second in that race. Beekeeper ran third. Was that the horse?
No, right, it wasn't. No, it was. I reckon it was a one-word name, English horse.
It's going to drive you mad now, isn't it?
Sorry, I brought it up, really.
Yeah. Let's get back to your broadcasting career. So all of a sudden, you go from Sydney to Perth. You do the apprenticeship in Perth.
Yeah.
How did you come over this side of the country?
Well, I applied for a job it was called the National Sporting Unit at the time, because the program didn't have a name, but the name finished up being Sports Night. So I joined this documentary program called Sports Night, whose host was a bloke named Frank Mills. Another reporter was a bloke named David Hill, who's become big overseas, and he left and he instituted the telecast for World Series cricket. And as a matter of fact, he didn't know much about cricket, but he knew a fair bit about television. He said, "We're going to televise it from both ends." And I said, "You can't do that. people want to know that Lily's bowling downwind and Alderman's into the wind with the breeze swinging away to slip and all that sort of stuff. He said, I couldn't care less. People are sick and tired of watching wicketkeepers' arses. So we're going to be televising cricket from both ends. So, you know, I disagreed. Guess who was right? And now every country in the world who televises cricket does it that way. Then he got snapped up by Rupert Murdoch, and so he lives in Los Angeles in this, you know, walled village and whatever else. And as a matter of fact, I believe the last gig he did was the Academy Awards.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Rupert got him in to do that the singing show. America.
Oh, there's only about 28 of them.
Yeah, but
America's Got Talent or something like that.
Yeah,
X Factor. Or,
well,
The
America's
Voice.
America's Got Talent, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was the executive producer of that because the ratings went down. And so Rupert said, get in, rescue that. So, you know, he's been that sort of a bloke. So I worked on Sports Night with Hilly, a lady named Mary Delahunty, who
yes.
became a minister in the Victorian government. And I was there for about 2.5 years. It finished up being a program. It got away from major sporting events. It started off being a magazine program, so you might have 3 8-minute stories or something in a half hour, that sort of thing. And it got away to one subject, half hour, sort of pretty major documentaries. And I thought, what am I doing? I've come over here to be a sports commentator. I'm not a Cecil B. DeMille. I was no filmmaker. I jumped out of a plane once and did a parachuting story and did a whitewater rafting story in Tasmania and...
Oh, look out.
Do I shout?
You know who that is? That's a slab. That's David Hill who's on the phone.
when the phone goes off in the studio,
yeah,
you've got to shout everybody. Thank
all right.
Gosh, there's not many here.
Good day for us then, Andy, by the look of it.
Yeah.
Anyway, you were saying...
So I was working in this documentary program for about 2.5 years. You know, some of the stories I did, Jeff Thompson catching wild pigs in country New South Wales. And that was the story where he said, I want to see batsman's blood on the pitch and all that sort of stuff. So we sold that little program to the BBC.
David Hill's just left a message, yes.
And so before they got to England for the 1975 World Cup and then played some test matches as well, you know, Tomo was this villain. Look out for this madman from the Antipodes coming over to see the Pommies' blood spilled on the pitch.
Face Tomo at one stage?
I did.
What happened there?
I went up to do a story with him. He was living in Brisbane, and he got this big contract to work for 4IP, and it was, you know, $480,000. I don't know whether it was a year or for 10 years or whatever. It was the equivalent of what Buddy Franklin got to go to Sydney, you know, all those years ago. So we went up and did a story. We did a story called Cash on Delivery, what some of these cricketers were earning away from the game of cricket. So here was Tomo and 4IP. Anyway, there was a plane strike and we couldn't get back. So we'd done all the filming. He had this blue Ferrari and we were roaring around the Ferrari and all that, water skiing on the Brisbane River and stuff like that. And anyway, the airstrike, we couldn't get back. So the cameraman, the sound recordist and I stayed at Tomo's place for about 3 days, unable to get out. Well, you know, filming done, so we enjoyed ourselves and went to the pub. And
a few libations.
Yeah, and so this day we had a few libations, and like a few jugs. And Tomo said, oh, I think I'll go down to the Gabba and have a bit of a hit in Sam Trimble's indoor nets. Oh, yeah, I'll come down as well. So he put on the pads and a few blokes bowled to him, and I bowled my little left arm dibbly dobblies, and, you know, he had a bit of a hit for about 10 minutes. And then he said, oh, I think I might have a bowl. He said, get the pads on. I said, oh, turn it up. I've had half a jug of beer, probably a whole, and I'm facing the great J.R. Thompson. He said, I'll just roll the arm over. Well, the first ball he bowled me, he did roll the arm over, and I don't know, I just got on the front foot and hit it right in the middle of the bat and belted it past him. And
not a good idea.
No, and it bounced off the back wall. And Tomo's thought, oh, actually, this bloke must be able to handle a bat. And the next one was about three times as quick.
Yeah.
I said, I'm out of here. See you later. I faced two deliveries because I thought it was going to be Brett Lee all over again with what he did with that Pommy bloke a couple of summers ago.
Oh, yes, Piers Morgan.
Yeah.
Oh, that was crazy. That really was crazy.
Yeah.
That could have been terribly dangerous.
Well, he even cleaned up Warnie.
Yeah.
That's un-Australian, isn't it?
I think it is. Cricket. When you talk about cricket, your eyes light up. Yeah. You loved broadcasting it. You love the game.
Yeah.
It's not an easy sport to broadcast because there is quite often 45 seconds to a minute when nothing's happening between deliveries and then maybe a couple of minutes. Sometimes the way they play it these days, 4 minutes between overs.
Yeah.
So you've got to do a lot of chatting in between. It's not broadcasting sport in the traditional sense, is it? It's more like a 6 or 7 hour conversation.
It's a conversation, yeah. And so you're 20 minutes on and 40 minutes off. And so it is to your advantage if on the 40 minutes off you don't just goof off and think nothing. You might actually think of a few things that you might say, whether you might talk music, your favourite song, you know, whatever. And it does help to have a bloke with you. You can bounce off. Look, you and I could broadcast the cricket all day because you and I, being great mates, we'd just rattle on. But Kerry O'Keefe, I mean, you could have a bit of fun with him. I was a bit different with Roebuck because he was that brilliant. It was like we were in a different stratosphere. I'm dumb and he's brilliant. And as a matter of fact, Jim Maxwell said to me, we were in Cape Town when he died, and we had a bit of a wake. And on the next day, Jimmy said to me, as a matter of fact, Roebuck said that he bowled you a few bounces, metaphorically, early in your combination with him on the radio, and he worked out that you couldn't handle it. So after that, he bowled you lots of half volleys. And you know, he was kind from that point of view because he could talk about the molecular makeup of the surface of Mars or something like that. He was unreal, and I just couldn't go with that sort of stuff. But yeah, you can rattle on. But cricket's this game where it can be so fast and so slow. I mean, I remember the day against India about three or four years ago at the SCG when Michael Clarke made 329 not out. Now, it was fantastic, and he was clubbing them all over the place and driving through the covers and whatever else. But, you know, when you go from 130 to 140 and then 220 to 260, it's a hell of a long time. And that was the day we actually had the chilies in the commentary box. Do you know the chili story?
I was listening. I sent you a text message that day. Could you give us the brief version of the chili story with Harsha Bogle in the box?
Well, I met some blokes sitting down in the Noble stand in front of the commentary box, and this bloke grows chilies in his backyard, and he said the hottest chili in the world, according to the Guinness Book of Records, is a Naga, N-A-G-A, Naga chili. He said, go up and see if Harsha Bogle will eat one of those on the air, because he's fully expecting that Harsh would pass out. So I finished my stint, and I said, well, that's the end of my 20 minutes, and joining Kerry O'Keefe now is Harsha Bogle. And I put the little box of chilies right in front, and I said, hey, go on, away you go. So the two of them, as you know, Michael Clarke went to 314 and 317, whack, whack, whack. Anyway, Harsha said, no, I don't eat hot chilies, even though he's an Indian. And Kerry said, well, I'm not eating the bloody things. Anyway, it's amazing how people are listening to the cricket while they're watching the cricket, and they're all onto it. And pretty much the whole of the Noble stand started to chant, eat the chilies, eat the chilies. And they were looking away from the cricket up to the commentary box. It was an absolute riot. It filled about 20 minutes while Michael Clarke just peeled off another, 20 runs that were just ridiculous. It filled a whole 20-minute commentary stint. Just it was just sensational.
Brilliant radio. Brilliant entertainment.
Yeah.
We'll take a break, Morfay. That's the way that I refer. When was
PD
the last time I
Morfay
called you Drew? I don't
Never.
Know. But we are going to take a break, and when we come back on the other side of the break, I want to talk to Drew about a program that made him famous around Australia. You probably heard of it. It's called The Winners. And it's even made a comeback. That's on the other side of the break. You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life on 1116 SEN for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Thanks for your company on another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Drew Morfitt, broadcasting legend, is my guest in the studio. Drew, The Winners, how did that come about?
Well, I hadn't very long been in Melbourne. Got here in 74 to do that documentary program, and got back into the sports department in 77. 77 was the first year of the winners, and it was devised by sporting supervisor Dick Mason, who unashamedly pinched the format of the show from The Big Match, which was the commercial version of English soccer, Premier League soccer, First Division, whatever it was called in those days, with Brian Moore. It had a few different hosts early, and I wasn't the original host. I might have been about the third.
Paul Sheehan did it, I think, at one stage, didn't he?
The ABC was keen to make Paul Sheehan a summer and a winter personality. He's obviously doing cricket, so they made him the host. But he wasn't seeing any footy because of school commitments or something. Didn't last very long. David Grant, who finished up being he was the interviewer on World Series Cricket.
Yes.
Where you had to say to Ian Chappell, "You've just made a first ball. Oh, what'd you make of that? What a great job he had." And I suppose I took over. I got the tap on the shoulder from Dick, and he said, I was commentating the games and I was the associate producer, so I was in the editing process and everything. And he said, "Oh, you could bloody host this." So, I don't know, it might have been, 2 months into the first season or something, I finished up hosting it. So,
of all the things you have done, is that probably the thing that made you best known right across Australia?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in Western Australia. Mm. They loved it over there because there were so many West Aussies playing in the VFL, as it was at the time, and South Australians to a large extent, but West Australians to a massive extent. I mean, I could walk down the street in Melbourne when I was hosting that program. Nobody knew me because it was all the big league and Peter Landy and Lou Richards and all that sort of stuff. Channel 7 was dominating. So this was the ABC show was a bit of a spare part in Victoria, but in South Australia and Western Australia, that's how they got their VFL footy, and that's all they got. So it was a religion over in WA.
And the tape actually had to go on a plane, did it not, and fly across to WA?
It did.
Yeah.
We'd record the show on a Saturday night, and it took the early morning flight over to Perth, and went to air at Sunday afternoon about 5 o'clock. And I've broadcast with blokes like Craig Starcevich. He said, we used to have mass Sunday afternoon, and the priest would say, "Righto, boys, final hymn. You got 20 minutes to get home and watch the winners." So the boys were, 14-year-olds, all charging home to watch the winners. And, of course, the priest was as well. Another story was Bill Walker, who won 3 Sandover medals, Billy Walker. He owned a couple of big pubs. And the big deal in Western Australia was the Sunday sessions, where they had a lunchtime session, then the pub had closed down, then an evening session. And he said it's the best thing for the pub industry of all time, the winners, because all he had to do was put up a big screen, and he said, "I'd be selling thousands of jugs a minute." Mm. It was huge. So,
What about the transition from the ABC, where you'd spent so much time, and then all of a sudden football goes back to Channel 7 after they lost it for a year, and you go to Channel 7? Was it a bit of a shock to go into the commercial world after all those years at the ABC?
Well, I was really flattered that they asked me, and it was a shock to go in there. Mind you, Pete, it nearly killed me because we're all smokers. Remember that?
Yes.
Remember that little office? There was about 9 of us all smoking. Peter Landy,
he didn't like it very much, no.
He'd have the window open on a day when the hail was coming in sideways just to survive. Channel 7 was, I didn't realise how hard it was going to have to work, because we had to do programs to fill half-time breaks and all that. So we were doing news stories during the week and doing 3 and 4 minute stories for the halftime filler. So by the time you got to the game, you'd had a week, all right. And you'd be flying interstate and all that. It was exciting. It was great being at 7.
Yeah, very exciting time. When they had the football back, they certainly made a big effort, because I think a lot of people at 7 saw it as their God-given right that they were going to have the football. And then 1987 happened, and they thought, well, we better do something about this.
Yeah, and the launch of it at the start of 88 was just unbelievable. The champagne and the decorations, it was in the studio at Dorker Street, and we came out from behind a curtain into this blaring bloody spotlight, and welcome Sandy Roberts, and welcome Peter Landy, and welcome Drew Morfin, and Dennis Cometti, and all that. It was, felt like I did feel a bit of a rock star. And then, of course, there was the story about how we used to be picked up by chauffeur-driven cars and taken to grounds. And let's say if I was doing a game at Waverley and I'd be doing it with Peter McKenna and Don Scott, we'd each have a car pick us up. So three separate cars would pick us up at home, drive out to Waverley, and then after the game, all three cars would be there to drive us back home with a bloke with a peaked cap and everything. It lasted about 4 weeks, I think, because the limo company found out that Scacey wasn't paying.
We'll take a break. As I said, we need 3 hours for this. We've only got one, so we've got one segment to go with Drew Morford. That's coming up after the break on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Our final segment on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives with Drew Morford. Drew, how many Olympics?
Six.
First one?
84 in LA for ABC Radio. I honestly thought I was ready to go at least one Olympics or maybe two before that. So having started in 66, I had to wait 18 years before my first Olympic trip. But great experience. Called a gold medal, the men's team pursuit. They beat the Yanks. The Yanks had won everything. They cheated like mad. All the talk at the moment is the Russians and the track and field Russians. Well, the American cyclists in 84 were just a disgrace. They hadn't won a gold medal in over 100 years, and all of a sudden they were winning everything. And when we stitched them up in the team pursuit, it was fantastic. So, yeah, I'll never forget 84.
You've called some fast people in your time over the journey at the Olympic Games. You weren't very quick in one particular aspect of your life, though, and that was with your beautiful now wife, Kaz, who was your partner for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And then I think it actually took until, was it not your 40th birthday?
It was.
That you decided to pop the question.
You were there?
I was.
Big night at
it
Silver's.
It was large, yes.
My 40th birthday, and I thought to myself, well, maybe 40 is, you know, is enough years to be single. I always thought, well, I'll outlast my father. He was 38 when he got married. Now, Prince Charles is about the same age as me, and he buggered things up by marrying Di. Mm. So I thought, well, gee, the pressure's on. So at my 40th, yes, I asked her if she'd marry me. And I hadn't really thought it out, but she did say yes. And then to try and sort of get a honeymoon in was pretty hard when you're doing football seasons and all that sort of stuff. My birthday's in August. Anyway, as it transpired, it was worked out that we had to get married before sort of February, when footy pre-season and all that. So I got married on the last day of the Australian Open tennis, which is quite a big day on the sports calendar.
Reasonably,
for Channel 7.
Yes.
They didn't like me too much for that.
And the partnership has gone on since then.
Yeah.
And Kaz, thankfully, is well now, because she had a period where things were not so good.
Yep. She was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she didn't even seek a second opinion. She said, right, get them out. And so she went through the operation, and it was horrendous, but just been remarkable. Some people get lucky with the treatment they get. Her surgeon, I could mention her name, but I probably won't. She was just absolutely sensational. And so Kaz is completely over it, forgotten all about it, and just getting on with life.
We often bump into people in our lives who are meant to be together. You see a couple and you think, you two are meant to be together.
Yeah?
I don't reckon I know a couple more like that than you and Kaz. You're a great match.
God, should see sometimes on a Friday night when we've had enough of each other.
Well, I haven't seen that, but I've
okay. Yeah.
And you love the horses. You both love the horses. Yeah. Horses are such a big part of your life now.
Our family's different from others. Most blokes have to lie about how many horses they have, and they don't tell their wives. They might say, oh, we've got one, but in actual fact, they've got five. Our family's different. I've got to stop her getting involved in horses, because we do run an adjustment property, and if we have a horse with some people who adjust horses with us, it encourages them to bring not only that horse back, but others. So it's good for business. Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions that I want to ask you in closing. One's a serious one. Do you harbour any bitterness towards the ABC for what went on at the end of last year that now sees you away from the ABC, still calling football for 6PR and also for AFL Live?
Yeah.
But did you really... Did the ABC do the wrong thing by you?
Well, I think they did. And I accused them of targeting me because of my age. And they said, no, no, it's absolutely, it's not age-related whatsoever. It's just budget cuts and, you know, something had to give. And, you know, I argued for a while. The bitterness is gone. You know, I've gotten over it. Because, look, there's plenty of people in the mining game, the car industry. You know, people are getting the sack left, right and centre and skimming along the footpath on their ass. And I'm just one of those. So, you know, very disappointed at the time. I'm saying, why me? I'm doing test cricket, league football, Olympic Games. Christ, you know, find somebody else. Mm. And it's not as though I was earning a fortune and was costing him a lot. But anyway, there you go.
Last question. When you sit back, if you ever retire, and I don't think you ever will, because I hope you don't, because you're too good at what you do. But when you sit back and reflect over your great career and all of the different sports and all of the different events... Give me the one where, if you listen to it back, you would say to yourself, you got that right, my boy. You nailed that one.
Don't know whether I've ever called anything that I thought, that was absolutely terrific. Gee, what a good call, you beauty. Pat myself on the back.
What's the closest you've come then?
Actually, the game that gets a run a few times is the first Essendon-Collingwood Anzac Day game in 95, which was the draw. And I've seen it back a few times and I'm thinking, I reckon I did okay. There's just, I think there was the right balance of a few stats and excitement and accuracy of the call and stuff like that. I was surprised to get the gig on a big game like that because, you know, usually Cometti's name had come out of that or Sandy, whatever. I did that with Peter McKenna, who's a terrific bloke, great mate of mine still. But, yeah, I'm pretty happy with the way that went. And others might say, oh, I saw that. That was rubbish. But whatever. But the broadcast that thrills me the most, that makes my hair stand on end, is reasonably recent. And that was the London Olympics. And, honestly, the women's sprint, Australia versus Great Britain, the Brits had absolutely toweled us up in everything. And when Anna Mears went past Pendleton, it was just phenomenal. And it was a great memory.
Yeah, spine tingling. Yeah. Moments that you'll never forget being a part of. I started this chat by saying that you're a broadcasting legend, and you are. You have the OAM to prove it, but you also have the respect of all of the people that you work with over the years. It's been great to sit down for an hour to have a chat to you. I wish it was three. And then we could tell a few of the other stories that we haven't told, like... when we celebrated Collingwood's premiership sitting in a hotel room in Delhi after they won the replay of the grand final, and it was Gandhi's birthday, and you couldn't buy a drop of alcohol anywhere in India. And so you supplied a bottle of red wine, which I don't drink that much. So I had about three drops, and you had the rest of the bottle. It's been a great friendship over the years, and it's been great to sit down and have a chat to you.
Thanks, Pete. And the sponsors of this show are very, very good too, because I'm getting close to needing them.
No, you haven't changed a bit over the years, and it'll be a while before you need to talk to the guys at Tobin Brothers Funerals. But they are celebrating lives, and they've celebrated the life of Drew Morfitt. Morfay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, PD.
And don't forget, you can catch us at the same time next week, same place, right here on 1116 SEN for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals.